So physical assessment is, I want to rule out factors first and foremost. I want to rule out a stiff shoulder. I want to rule out an unstable shoulder. I want to try and rule out pain that might be referring into the area. If I've ruled out all of these factors here and I'm not worried about any sinister pathology, then I've got this hypothesis that it might be related to soft tissues.
Shoulder pain is super common in the clinic, and the narrative and evidence around shoulders has really shifted in the last 5 to 10 years. Well, today we had Jared Power on, also known as the Shoulder Physio. He's a musculoskeletal physiotherapist from the Gold Coast. He's studying a PhD in this area, and he also teaches in this area. He really unpacked some of the definitions, the terminology, and what we might use instead of those common terms like impingement. And he also spoke about his subjective and objective processes and how he's updated that over time. My name is Michael Risk, and this is Physio Explained. Welcome, Jared, and thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me, Michael. Glad to be here.
Awesome, mate. You've got a masterclass coming out for Physio Network in 3 or 4 days, and this will be the 15-minute preview, I reckon. We're going to start with subacromial impingement and your understanding of the definition and the pathophysiology, and should we still be using that terminology?
Yeah, so subacromial impingement is easily the rock star of shoulder pain. It is the big dog. It is the thing we're all trained in. It's been heavily challenged really over the last 10, 20 years. It was suggested 50 years ago nearly by Charles Neer as this abrasion or friction of the subacromial tissue underneath the overlying acromion. And that was suggested to be the primary driver of shoulder pain. And it just really hasn't borne out in the literature over the last 20 or 30 years. However, it's still being taught. It's still very much being referred to in clinic and also in academic research papers, but it kind of doesn't exist. We know that most shoulders or all shoulders impinge to some degree when you lift your arm up in the air. We've had really good systematic reviews that have come out actually in the past 12 months, which show that the subacromial space really isn't linearly correlated with pain. It doesn't need to improve for pain to decrease. People with shoulder pain don't have a more reduced subacromial space versus people without shoulder pain. So it just seems to be this thing that we kind of observed 50 years ago. Then we made a theory about it, and then we sold it to the masses, and it became really quite successful. Then we invented surgeries for it. We invented injections for it. We invented exercises for it. So it kind of spawned this entire industry. But it's a little bit fallible in terms of the evidence behind it.
Well, I still remember off air, I was just saying when I started as a physio, I remember the old explanation of the ball going up into the socket and you're getting a pinching. So the research is showing that's not really what happens. Is there any pathophysiology or inflammation in the bursa or the cuff tendons in that space, or is that also not happening?
Yeah, no, that definitely happens. So sort of biomechanical or biochemical variants definitely do exist, and structure is one part of this whole biopsychosocial paradigm, which is how we approach pain now. So definitely, there's sort of inflammatory mediators in the bursa. We know that there is an influx of biochemical alterations in people in the rotator cuff, in people with subacromial shoulder pain. So these do exist. It's just not your destiny. So it's just not all about that. And we just have to zoom out and have a look at all the other factors that can sensitize our pain system or lead to the onset or persistence of shoulder pain. So I never want to diminish the contribution of physical or structural factors. It's just not only about those factors.
Yeah, I think we're probably getting into a distinction. So we can't say it's that ball driving up into the socket and it's pinching, but we can say there might be some inflammation around the bursa or tendon, but then we can't say that inflammation is the sole cause of your pain. Is that the gist?
Yeah, spot on. You can never really know the causation. We can observe correlations, but I think we should never reduce somebody's pain experience to what we can see on a scan or how they move. It's just far more complex and convoluted. The other thing is, if you don't mind me just going off on a little bit of a tangent, if somebody comes in with shoulder pain and we say you have subacromial impingement, then what does that person perceive or understand based on that diagnosis? And it sets them up for this whole biomedical interpretation. And we have really good qualitative studies on that. If they receive a diagnosis of subacromial impingement straight away, their brain goes, well, that means that something is rubbing on my tendon whenever I lift my arm. And how can that set that person up to be confident to move if that is their understanding of pain? So this whole narrative surrounding terminology and nomenclature, I think, is super important, even more important than the actual validity of the diagnosis itself.
That's a really good tangent. What kind of language do you use and how has that changed for yourself now?
Yeah, it's a fabulous question. It varies. I use subacromial shoulder pain, and that people sort of can criticize that term, and that's fine. I use rotator cuff related shoulder pain often as well, which is a term suggested by Jeremy Lewis. I like that term too. It's a clinical hypothesis, right? So the way I want to set up people to understand their shoulder pain is that we can't be certain if it's coming from a structure. However, we know it's in your shoulder. I find the diagnosis of just shoulder pain or non-specific shoulder pain as being very underwhelming for the patient. They're coming to us for validation and for a diagnosis. And rightly or wrongly, I think we should give them one. It makes their pain far more coherent to them. So I say you may have something called rotator cuff related shoulder pain. I don't know where it's coming from precisely, but what do you know about the rotator cuff? And they'll say, well, it's a muscle, it exercises, right? So it sets them up to have this belief that exercise or active intervention might be their pathway forward, as opposed to injections or getting the acromion shaved off or something like that.
I like that. You're touching on something there, the value of a diagnosis for a patient. And then sometimes my brain goes to, do we need to give the diagnosis? Because once we start talking to the patient about loading it, or you've had a sharp spike in your load, so of course you're going to have a sore shoulder, and then give them the plan. Sometimes you don't even need a diagnosis, or yep. Do you feel that there is still value in giving that label?
Depends on the person. If somebody very much wants to know what's wrong with them, and that is totally normal, that is how the world works from a Newtonian physics perspective. We want to know cause and effect, right? So if somebody really presses me on it, then I'll give them something to take home. I'm very careful with what I choose. I don't remember the last time I said to someone, you have a rotator cuff tear or you have subacromial impingement. Very rarely. But you're right. Somebody just over the course of the consultation and chatting and giving information and then experimenting with movement, et cetera, they'll forget that they need a diagnosis. They just want a plan. They want a management plan so they can have some sort of a pathway forward to manage their pain.
I think that's really cool. And it'll almost tell you you've navigated the consult quite well. And sometimes you'll get that patient come back second visit and say, Hank, what was wrong with me? So yep. You could always go into it there, right?
Totally. And it always breeds a conversation. So if somebody really wants to know, then I'm like, well, this is what we call it. But remember that rotator cuff related shoulder pain is a multidimensional condition at the mercy of infinite psychological, social, cognitive, emotional factors, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So whilst this might be it, don't reduce that experience to what we see on your MRI scan.
Mm. If we were talking about assessment now, kind of covered the pathophysiology and what we might say in the interview, assessments change quite a bit. I remember standing behind patients and looking at how much the scap rotated up and maybe even kyphosis from the side. So less structural, less biomedical, what are you really looking for in assessment now?
So physical assessment is, I want to rule out factors first and foremost. I want to rule out a stiff shoulder. I want to rule out an unstable shoulder. I want to try and rule out pain that might be referring into the area. If I've ruled out all of these factors here and I'm not worried about any sinister pathology, then I've got this hypothesis that it might be related to soft tissues of the shoulder and just related to that. So not primarily, I'm always considering the human being underneath it as well. So usually I'll do manual muscle testing. I'll get out my handheld dynamometer and I'll test force production, but I'm not obsessed with that. Like I'm not like, you must increase your strength in order to get better. It just gives me a metric as to how that person can meet external load. And then we might check in every few weeks. I really love doing functional testing. So how much weight can this person lift to fatigue in an endurance manner? So take a 2-kilo weight, How many scaption raises can that person do to fatigue? How can they lift a weight overhead? And what's their reaction when they're doing it? How are they feeling? Are they exhibiting fear? Do they look cautious? Do they have a stiff movement profile? And then I ask them about it. Well, you look a bit cautious when you're doing that. Can you tell me why? And so it's this collaboration and exploration of movement. They're doing something. We're talking about it and we're trying to figure out how it's all going. We don't know where we're going. We don't know what the exercises are going to be that that person is going to do at home. We're just trying to figure it all out based on the individual in front of us. So my assessment is very dynamic. It's very flexible, but it always involves exploring how that person moves, how they respond to load, how they feel about the movement, how safe they feel doing particular movements.
I have a working theory that with the evidence in the last 10 years, maybe that the objective part of the consult is potentially coming shorter, which is a good thing because we can have longer, more robust conversations or spend a little bit more time doing exercises and watching them lift weights overhead, for as an example. What are your thoughts?
Totally. So my assessment now, which is kind of like movement exploration, et cetera, is treatment. So assessment is treatment. So I don't do special tests, really. I don't really spend a hell of a lot of time palpating. You know, I'll have a cursory glance at things. I'll look at the scapula for a minute, make sure everything's in place and it's not dislocating out and I don't get a vomit response. But I'll make sure that shoulder's attached, that person can move. I'll try and rule out that they don't have something called a pseudo paralysis, which might be indicative of a massive full thickness cuff tear, which in that case I might refer on. But yeah, you're right. My physical examination, traditional physical examination, which is what we're taught, is over in a couple of minutes. And then we're out in the gym, we're exploring movement. It's pretty cool. I quite enjoy it, actually.
Yeah. And you touched on some scapular stuff there, which I wanted to get into. So I was explaining my clinical journey. I was looking at the scap and I was doing T's and Y's and activations. And then I did an Adam Meekins course 3 years later. And then it's like, maybe I can just do two really hard exercises. And seemingly both treatment approaches got the same result, not for the reason I was thinking it was. So I had a question. When you see someone's scapula moving around, or maybe not moving, maybe there's no upward rotation, how do you reconcile the way the evidence is shifted with, man, they've got a sore shoulder, they seem stuck, and if that scapula moved, would it actually help them? Where are you at with that thought process?
Yeah, possibly, for sure. So let's just start with scapular dyskinesis. So it's usually, we think scapular dyskinesis is any type of abnormal movement of the scapula, typically protraction of the scapula and downward rotation of the scapula, which reduces the subacromial space, which is meant to cause pain when you lift your arm up overhead. So there's many, many problems with scapular dyskinesis. Firstly, it's the assessment. Visual observation of the scapula is very poor. Like we actually cannot reliably detect it. And also we show confirmation bias when we're looking for it because we want to see it. Therefore, we do see it. That's confirmation bias. So there's many studies out there that prove that. And then it's, well, can we change scapular dyskinesis with our treatment? And we can't really. We've got a ton of studies that show that pain and function improve with a rehabilitation program, but scapular mechanics remain pretty much the same. So they might just be individual to that human that they've developed over 40 or 50 years. And to think that we can change it in a 60-minute session or 30-minute session, I think is a little bit arrogant. So we actually don't need to. Now, if somebody's locked and not upwardly rotating their scapula at all, that's something we definitely need to address because you've got to have 60 odd degrees of upward rotation of the scapula to have full range of motion. So with really profound things, definitely we can engage and try and get it moving a little bit better. But if we're nitpicking and saying it's 3 degrees below or it's activating at the wrong time or the lower trap's coming on too late and the upper trap's over dominant, I think that is a bit of a waste of time and the evidence reflects that.
There's some really good thought there. So you could do the things a good health professional would do. So like maybe reduce load at the start, then poke the bear, then load it a little. And they got better and probably stronger, but the scapula stayed the same. The biomechanics of the scapula stayed the same. Something I'd love you to challenge me on is I was thinking about kyphosis. And let's say, you know, someone is quite rounded and, you know, they're sitting in this curled up position. We would imagine an old office worker. My brain goes to, I know the research that says I don't need to fix that for them to feel better. But then my brain goes, if I could over time get the more thoracic extension, would they not have more available range, and would more available range be beneficial to them? I sometimes get caught between those two mindsets. Do you have any thoughts on that?
It's a really good question. So yes, thoracic range of motion is paramount for shoulder range of motion, for sure. It's just, it's a tenuous relationship between having increased thoracic kyphosis and the experience of pain. So if somebody has a goal to get back to sport that requires a lot of shoulder range, like swimming, for example, or tennis in a serving position, then pursuing optimizing thoracic mechanics makes a lot of intuitive sense. And I'm all for that. I'm just aware that by improving that may not necessarily translate to reductions in pain. It may, but what's the causal relationship there? Is it just the fact that they're doing exercise and doing movement that's improved their shoulder pain, or is it the restoration of posture and mechanics? We actually don't know. We know that these like biomechanical factors aren't really mediators of pain. Like, we know they don't really need to change, but for performance and range of motion, et cetera, it makes sense to kind of optimize that, whatever that means, to the best of your ability.
That's a good distinction, I think, for young health professionals, that there is a difference there between that's not going to mediate pain, but it will help performance. Then I'm starting to think, are there any studies that show, well, when they have increased range or increased performance, are they less likely to get pain? To my knowledge, it's a no. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, no. So maybe shoulder strength is a preventative factor for developing rotator cuff related shoulder pain. We've kind of got a couple of studies that allude to that. But in my belief is that injury is multifactorial. It's at the mercy of a number of different factors. Actually, often the biggest predictors of developing pain and also reducing pain are sort of psychosocial constructs as opposed to physical constructs. But I've written a paper recently challenging strength and rotator cuff related shoulder pain. I'm a big fan of strengthening. It's just not all about that. But what we're finding is that it's factors outside of structural, outside of physical, and more related to person level factors, which influence the onset and also the improvement of pain as well.
We've covered a lot of ground here, Jared. With 1 minute left, could you speak a little more to some of those psychosocial mediators you found in the paper?
Yeah, so baseline factors of kinesiophobia, catastrophizing, optimism, self-efficacy, et cetera, are more of the biggest predictors of getting better with physiotherapy with shoulder pain, as opposed to how big your rotator cuff tear is, or where your rotator cuff tear is located, or the tightness of your pectoralis minor, or the intricacies of the movement of your scapula. So we're seeing those things might matter a little bit, but these other more person level factors might be a little bit more influential in determining who gets better and who doesn't get better. We've seen that in the shoulder, we've seen it in the lumbar spine, we're seeing it in other joints as well. It kind of makes sense.
Jared, there's so many pearls in that, and you've got a longer masterclass where you go a little bit deeper into each one of those topics launching in a couple of days. Thank you so much for your time, mate, and we'll see you on the masterclass as well.
Thanks, Michael. Really enjoyed it, mate. Cheers.